Wherever you are in the world, this is Grant Cameron, and we have a special panel today. The latest book, Skinwalkers at the Pentagon, has been released, and we've brought in some expert people to talk about the book. I think everybody's basically read the book or part of the book. And so let me introduce Alan Steinfeld from New Realities is here. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you, Grant. This is a very important conversation because there's so many pieces that just kind of been put into this a puzzle that we've been trying to understand. So beautiful. Yeah, great to be here.
And Tom Whitmore is joining us. Tom, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah,
great to be here.
And of course, we've got Science Bob, Bob McGuire.
Nice to be here. Grant, had been looking forward to this.
Yeah, exciting times. And Nicole Sackage will be with us in a moment. And we have two producer people on. We have my assistant, Desta Barnaby, who is sort of running things for my channel, but it's also coordinated by Neil Gower from Portals to Ascension, and we thank him. We have this thing multiple streamed on numerous channels, so it'll be widely distributed, and that's what we wanted, because this is an important book. I think everybody on the panel agrees it's an important book, and I think everybody will pick up something from what's said here today. So let's start with Tom Whitmore. You were the first I heard that.
Let's start with the book, Grant. Can we talk about, some people tuning in might not know the book we're talking about. So can you just kind of introduce the book first?
Okay. So the book was written by Kelleher from, he was with Bass. He was with NIDS. He's a big assistant with Bob Bigelow and James Lakatsky, was one of the main people who ran the whole ATIP operation, the government exploration into the UAP phenomena. And it's also, George Knapp is also an author on it.
Skinwalkers at the Pentagon, just so people know.
Yeah. And it's basically a book that goes into, for the last 4 years since the New York Times posted the article, everybody's been looking at, hearing these stories about OSAP and ATIP and all these sort of things. And there was all sorts of rumors and lots of disinformation going around. And so what this basically does is it clarifies what the program was, who was involved in the program. It exposes a lot of new names, a lot of new organizations. And I think everybody agrees that this has a lot of material. If you're into this kind of what's the government up to and what's going on and what do they know, this is a fantastic book to read. I know my personal reading with it, I had a lot of flow states where I had to stop. I was sort of getting in ideas like write this down. And then I'd have to go for a walk and then I'd read some more and I'd write it down. So I was just amazed by the book. But let's start with Tom. I think you were the first to talk about the book. Give us your take on the book and what impressed you. What do you think was missing?
Okay. Well, as we all know, this this article came out from the New York Times in 2017, and I'm on the MUFON board, and I was on the MUFON board when this transpired back when OSAP got going. And at the time, we were told that the money, of course, we understood there was a lot of money involved, and we were curious about where it was coming from. And what we were told is that it was a third party private funding situation. You know, these types like Crown Prince of Liechtenstein or Lawrence Rockefeller type people. Then in 2017, when the article came out, I read it and I about went through the ceiling because I put two and two together and I realized the money was coming from the Congress, but through DOD, through the DIA. So needless to say, I was interested. And then, like you said, Grant, we've heard all of these rumors and all of these stories and Elizondo and blah, blah, blah since 2017 about ATIP and all the confusion about OSAP. So when I read this book and I sat down a couple of days ago and read the whole thing, it's like manna from heaven in terms of information, because it cleared up a lot of questions that I think we all have had about where this came from, how it transpired. And of course, there's a whole lot of other information in there about some things that turned up at at Skinwalker Ranch and a lot of other things. Now, my particular area of interest is the history of the MJ-12 affair, and I've been working on a paper on AFOSI. So in the section of the book where they talked about Colonel Hennessy and his remarks, I found that particularly interesting. So I think we're just getting started. And like I said, on Twitter and on Facebook, I think this book is going to inspire a lot of conversation, a lot of controversy for a long time. You're muted, Grant.
I did the MJ-12 thing already back in the 1980s. So let me ask you a question about this Hennessy thing. And Hennessy was supposed to, at one time, he was Lee Graham used to say he was the Falcon. He was Richard Doty was reporting to him. So in light of this, when I looked at it, and I want to ask you about it, it looked like it sort of validated what was going on with the Bill Moore thing, because everybody thought this was total disinformation. And then you see Hennessy appear in this book, and he's basically sort of clearing up that, you know, it wasn't Russian satellites. It was, you know, it was more operational than we think in terms of actually studying UFOs rather than, you know, just some program that somebody stumbled upon that had nothing to do with UFOs.
No, I read it the opposite way, that he was in charge of a program to monitor and manipulate the UFO groups. Because at the time they were working on the B-2 stealth bomber, they were working on the stealth fighter, the F-117, and they wanted the public's attention diverted away from that. And now I'm not saying that AFOSI or DIA or any of that doesn't have anything to do with UFOs, because I think they do. But I think we can be fairly confident that there was some kind of program to manage the UFO scene in the 1980s. And really, when you think about it, you don't have to be a genius to figure out what UFO people want to hear. And that may have had something to do with a lot of the rumors and stories that were floating around in the 1980s and that are still with us today.
Okay, super. Let's go to Bob McGuire. I mean, you were pretty excited about the book. You read it. What's your impression, and what do you think we can take away from this book?
Okay, so I want to amplify on some things that Tom just said. It's pretty clear that, kind of reading between the lines, even though they brush right up next to it in the book, they don't say whether or not AFOSI ever did exactly what they wanted them to, which was provide them with a list of classified programs that would allow Bass to deconflict the reports so they could concentrate on those events that were not considered SAP or covered by an AFOSI piece of knowledge. So in other words, if we have a secret plane or a secret program or secret drone or whatever, Bass didn't want to look at it, and they went to AFOSI to try to set up a relationship that would allow them to call out things from the MUFON database and their own other collections that were part of these SAP programs. And they just leave you like in a pregnant pause. And I believe that's one of those places in the book where they said, cut out everything from here concerning what AFOSI actually did with Bass, because they just leave you hanging there. Okay, that was one thing I wanted to comment on, Tom. And it's easily read, and you can read about AFOSI PJ in the book and just see where all these things are covered and where these conversations happen. So the first thing I want to comment on is, way back when we heard about Bass and those things, when things started blowing up, the first thing I did was go to Fed BizOps and try to figure out the details of this contract that DIA gave to Bigelow and Bass. And the thing that's, look, they keep trying to say in public and keep trying to say in this book that there was no preferential treatment given to Bigelow. And I'm going to tell you, that stinks like a pile of poo. And I'm going to explain to you why. Months before the federal contract was put out to the public, Bigelow was setting up Bass to work on it. So when the August release date for the contract was put out, they had 3 or 4 weeks to respond, and nobody but Bigelow was ready. This is how you manipulate the system to give a contract to someone that you want to make sure they get it. You make sure that it's done by the letter of the law, but what they do is arrange it so only one group can get it. And so
that was the Reed connection, right? Right. That was Reed's doing. Yeah.
Actually, it's Lukotsky's doings. You're getting to an important point. The other thing I think we now know with more certainty than we knew before this book came out is at the heart of the entire whirlpool of events, there's one name, and I had not given him credit. One name that I had not given credit for gluing all of this together is a certain investigative reporter in Las Vegas. George Knapp is at the heart and center of all of it. And how do we know this? He introduced Harry Reid to Bigelow and NIDS. Then he called on Harry Reid and Bigelow together with Knapp, and Reid and Bigelow worked out this deal for how they got Bass funded to do OSAP. So it was NIDS, Bigelow, and Knapp called in Harry Reid to come to their board meetings. Harry Reid got all fired up, went and talked to two other senators. Then these senators are these gang of eight are on these particular committees. They can figure out how to write a check for some amount of money. Their limits, but $22 million is when they're in their limits. And George Knapp has been kind of around and circulating and putting people together since the very beginning in 1989 when he blew open
Can I ask you a question?
51 story, yeah.
How does Lukotsky come in? Was that at random or was that – where's the connection with Lukotsky
No. So Lukotsky heard about NIDS, and George Knapp and I believe Harry Reid were contacted by Lukotsky on his own recognizance, on his own interest. He inserted himself into wanting to do work using NIDS out at Skinwalker Ranch. And so Lukotsky got going, and he got an okay to spend money through the Harry Reid, Ted Stevens from Alaska connection, and got the okay, got top secret SI through the DIA setup. Bigelow bought a building and turned out it wouldn't be a skiff. So Bigelow had to go find another building in Las Vegas that NSA would certify. That building had NSA security classification certification. It was to the highest standards you can possibly put in the government on a classified facility that's not a black sap. So,
but Bob, can I ask you this? It seems like a coincidence that Lukotsky got involved. That's the way that they presented it in the book. But you're saying that Bigelow was already setting up Bass and all that. All that was pre-planned.
No. Lukotsky came in while Bigelow was still running NIDS and said, I want to go to Skinwalker Ranch and some other things. And so he began doing the circulating around with the senators and others through the George Harry Reid Bigelow connection to get all of that going. Three and a half week trigger is the thing that tells you they wanted to fund Bigelow, who owns Skinwalker Ranch, to do some stuff.
Can I add something?
Okay, that's fine.
Because my thing was always the thing about forget about the whole Nimitz thing. I was always interested and said we should know what Skinwalker Ranch is about. And that's the way I read the book was Lukotsky read Skinwalker Ranch book. And he said it was circulating in the Middle East with all the people. It was around the swimming pool and all that sort of stuff. And they're all reading it. And that's why he went there, because he looked at all this paranormal phenomena and said, wow, if we could develop this, if we could figure this out. And that's why they went. It wasn't so much for UFOs. It was for the paranormal stuff at Skinwalker Ranch. And that's why he went to Skinwalker Ranch.
So when NIDS was ongoing, they named this AFO, this former intelligence guy, who was the one that passed Hunt for Skinwalker around the intelligence circles in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And he told them about the 2004 Nimitz case. So that was kind of the first one where they ran around all over the place interviewing all the people we now know from TV about 2004. And then They started developing this interest through Bigelow and Skinwalker Ranch and all the weirdness. Lakatsky found out from all these people who were in these military circles something weird was going on, and maybe every kind of weird phenomenon you can find can be studied at Skinwalker Ranch. And so Lakatsky went and got himself in, and they formed this contract relationship with Bass. And it's clear to me that it was always going to Bigelow, especially when nobody had a chance to put together anything except Bigelow. And he started putting together Bass before the contract was on the street. So one more kind of tidbit, and I'll shut up and let others talk, is, you know, they said they had to use pseudonyms. And there's just one that just stands out like a sore thumb. There's this medical guy that's involved with NIDS, involved with Bass, and keeps being around, and they call him Norman Black. That, to me, is almost surely a pseudonym for Dr. Kit Green.
Well, Bob, you didn't talk about ATIP at all. Where is ATIP? Can you just tell people why?
Yes, I will.
And also, we've been under the illusion that it was all ATIP for 4 years, the whole public, everyone in the media, and now it's not. So go ahead.
So when Lakatsky and the three senators funded the program that wound up being executed by Bigelow at Bass and involved investigations of the Nimitz and Skinwalker Ranch, to name a couple, there are many more in the book, the program was called OSAP from the get-go. So after a year and a few months of investigation, Harry Reid, as a member of the Gang of Eight and other things, saw all sorts of information that let him believe and know that the Russians and the Chinese were going crazy trying to figure out these UAP things. And so he went to the Pentagon person in charge of SAP programs and said, look, the Russians and the Chinese, they're going crazy trying to figure this out. And we're sitting around here with our thumb in a dark place. We need to get going. And in order to cover this correctly, we need certain parts of, especially these technical reports as they relate to the dirds that we all know about, technical reports, we need them to be inside of a SAP so we can work with the other parts of the government that have access to knowledge so we can see how this stuff goes. And so the SAP, the letter that went to a person in the Pentagon, called the program ATIP. That was a word that Harry Reid and whoever made up to cover up the name of OSAP. And you can read clearly in the book, in multiple places, DIA was constantly afraid of OSAP getting above the sea level, where that's spelled S-E-E, sea level, and get stomped on by opponents in the Pentagon and elsewhere. So he called it ATIP to cover up the fact that it was actually OSAP. And it just goes to speak to how large and incredibly complicated the Pentagon and Pentagon contracting is. So ATIP was a pseudonym that later got picked up, according to the book and to others, as the informal name for the working group that involved Elizondo and others.
And that's one of the criticisms I saw in the some of the comments, was the fact that they kept repeating that whole thing about the difference between ATIP and OSAP. And it's almost like there's different people writing the book, because they did repeat it maybe five or six times, almost like it was they wanted to get it across, or multiple people were writing the book.
I think this book was rushed out to meet a deadline, and it would have edited a little better. But I do believe that there's multiple people writing this book, and they each kind of wrote a part that they knew about, and they each wanted to emphasize this OSAP, ATIP, et cetera thing. And they're trying to let everybody know they were first before Elizondo came on the scene. So, but I agree with you. It reads like multiple people are writing different sections, and they did not have enough editorial help to deconflict it.
Well, I was just wondering where Elizondo stands now. He was the front guy, and now what position does he look like he's in now, leading this UAP sort of disclosure program?
He's a private citizen, and he started a private company with other people to do whatever work he's going to do. So, but Sky Ford or something like that. So anyway, what when he was still working in the Pentagon, the informal activity he participated in was ATIP. He had assigned duties inside the Pentagon, and along with other people, they were informally meeting under the aegis of a name, ATIP, which they just extracted from what Harry Reid did when he tried to cover up OSAP with a name. And they just continued their little activity and called it ATIP. But we don't actually know from this book if ATIP ever actually got further funding or not, but it appears they were allowed to continue this activity, probably under orders, to just check this UAP stuff and keep the stuff going to the best of their ability with tiny or no funding.
Can I ask a question for the people who would know? Was it known before about Lou Elizondo and the remote viewing thing, or did they out him on that? Because I didn't know it until I think it was in the book where he was doing remote viewing.
Did not know it.
He did mention it on one interview that he was familiar with it, but I think it was maybe the
here. People here I think they basically say he was a remote viewer. He was in there. And whether that's outing him or whether they just figured it was, you know, no big deal.
You know, that's some of the things about the book, Grant. They talk about paranormal. They talk about remote viewing. They even talk about abductions. And this is coming from inside the government. This is new to have this kind of conversation out there in public. Wouldn't you say that, Grant?
Absolutely. That's one of the things. I've got a number of things I wanted to bring up. But you mentioned that, and that's where I made that posting. And I said, all the days of the consciousness deniers are numbered, because they go there twice. It's in the Bass proposal about this paranormal consciousness thing. And in at the end, and maybe somebody can comment on that. In the end, they have that proposal and they say, I think that I'm maybe I'm reading it wrong. They didn't say that the government should run. It should be run in private operation. And they list off whatever it is, 7 or 8 things that should be studied. And I think number 5 was consciousness. And when I saw that, it was like, here's these official guys going public and saying, this is part of the story. Cause you know what people will say when you bring up consciousness, oh, that's all woo woo. That's, you know, love and light stuff. This is all nonsense. That you just, you know, this is not crazy stuff. And they go there, they go to the consciousness thing, and they go to the whole paranormal thing at Skinwalker Ranch, which I always said was the most important part of the whole story. Oh. I think that's what they were trying to figure out, was this paranormal thing. How do you put bulls inside trailers? How do you put talking inside people's heads? How do you make stuff appear and disappear and stuff like that? And that's how it started. It may have gone into looking at Nimitz later on and the whole UFO thing, but I'm pretty sure the Katsky thing, that's to his original intention. And what I found was very funny there, and I didn't realize until I read it, was that Lukatsky goes there and he gets in through Reed, and they fly him in there and all this sort of stuff on Bigelow's jet and stuff. And when he gets there, he sees this metallic tube thing that's on this album of I can't remember what the name of the band is, but he said it looked
Led
like
Zeppelin.
No, it wasn't Led Zeppelin. It was, I posted it on Facebook, but they talked about it on George Knapp's show one time, but he said that's the closest thing it resembled, but it was this tube type thing. Only he could see it in the room while this meeting was going on. It was there for 30 seconds and then it disappeared. And it was almost like, when I saw that, I thought, is the whole idea when Jim Semivan was asked, who's running the show? And he said, they are. And when I saw that, I go like, this may have almost been like disclosure, that this is the intelligence disclosing. Like, did they really have, do you think this is coincidence that this thing appeared in front of Lukatsky at this meeting? He was only on the ranch for 45 minutes or something, the first meeting. And this thing appears for 30 seconds. And then he's hooked. He figures, I've got to do this. This thing's for real. It's almost like they're saying, welcome, doctor. We've been waiting for you. And like, here comes the show. And this is a part of a disclosure effort by the intelligence. Because the other thing they brought up, which part of it I knew, but the other part I didn't know, is the thing about Kenneth Arnold. Kenneth Arnold saw the 9 objects, but then a couple days later, he had the orbs in his bedroom, and he had an owl, which I think maybe they mentioned in the book, or they didn't mention in the book. And then it was, 5 weeks later, he had these 20 to 25 copper objects come out the plane. And then you wonder, like, is this coincidence? And that was my whole deal about the UFO thing. Is this a random phenomena that just happened to come in here? Or is this a phenomena where the intelligence itself is unraveling these things? Because those kind of things, I don't think those things are random. I think those are events where they're staging this stuff, almost like the idea of the crashes where you get Bigelow and you get Tim Taylor and Jacques Vallée saying they're starting to believe that the crashes and all this kind of stuff are gifted material. That's what I, when I saw these kind of things, that's what sort of stuck out to me, was this idea that the intelligence is playing this game, and they were more than happy to have the military come in because they're going to put this message out and everybody's going to be interested in it. And it's going to raise the consciousness of the fact that we're not alone and something's going on.
I think you ought to, one of the things we ought to do is Lukatsky, guarantee you he knew who Colonel John Alexander was. And John Alexander was in NIDS and then involved in Bass. So Lukatsky would have known Alexander, and no one's mentioned it, but I promise you Alexander is involved or in and around all of the stuff that goes in the book. And he may even be one of the pseudonyms in the book, but I couldn't figure out which one of the pseudonyms would have been him, especially since he's now out in the open. And one more thing to your point, Grant, is not a single person that's featured in one of those chapters in the book that had a strange experience at Skinwalker Ranch failed to take a hitchhiker home and literally wreak havoc on their families.
Well, that's one thing I actually contacted John Alexander about in the last couple of days, because what I heard that John Alexander didn't have anything. And George Knapp didn't have anything. His wife had something, but he didn't have anything. He even said, I would love to. He sat out in there and waiting for something to happen. And when I look at that sort of stuff, and you know, Bob, this is where my main point in the book is, why did they have this negative stuff follow them? Because you know that if you've studied experiencers, that all experiencers have the hitchhiker. This is very common. Chris Bledsoe, when he had his experience, and one of my main questions is, Chris Bledsoe is not in this book. Why is Chris Bledsoe? He was asked for material from the intelligence, was briefed to the president of the United States. He's out of this book. And
so remember, this is mostly about OSAP. And okay, the first person that interviewed Chris Bledsoe was like Elizondo and those kinds of people. So Chris Bledsoe was interviewed kind of at the end of OSAP's existence. And these people are talking principally about OSAP. So I think Chris Bledsoe is right on the boundary when Elizondo took over. And I'm telling you, after my experiences with Chris Bledsoe, I had hitchhikers.
Exactly. But yours wasn't.
Who was the guy in Georgia, though, that they talk about in the book? I thought that may have been Chris Bledsoe. There was a case in Georgia they talk about.
He's in North Carolina.
Yeah, but they mentioned something about, anyway.
And that's the thing, is Chris had it come home. And I remember talking to him about the, and they use the, you know, the scary, what do they call it? The ferocious, or they use some word about dark figures. And everybody has the shadow people. I even asked Chris Bledsoe, and he was telling me about the shadow people. And I talked to all the kids, and I talked to his wife about the shadow people. And I said, well, what are they doing? Oh, they're just going along the wall. They're two-dimensional. They're flying through into the next room and stuff like that. Everybody had those experiences. And yet, did Chris Bledsoe have these real negative experiences that these guys brought back? Because when you had the hitchhiker, you had the experience with them, you took it home, and you had the healing stuff that followed you home. So it's this idea that, and I would say the quantum physics now is no longer more about particles. It's about field theory. And this idea that you have a field, and that it comes down to this impression of these military guys that were on the ranch, and they had this experience with the phenomena, and they had the fear thing. Chris had that too. I don't know if he ever told you the story about the guns. He had exactly the same thing where he had the gun. I don't know if you know the story where he gave up all the guns, where he had that, the fear. I had that fear thing too. When the craft comes in close, it's almost got, it's got a field around it, and you can't express the fear and that overcomes you. So Chris had all these positive, and these guys are showing all this negative stuff. And I actually, I read the book, I actually had sympathy for Christian fundamentalists. In terms of the fact that there's no sort of aliens in the book. There's if you take the Tic Tac thing out, you basically, this looks like demons. It looks like, yeah, you know, this kid gets inundated in the middle of the night. And then you see the field theory that when that kid got hit with those orbs in the middle of the night, and the same thing happened. And at the same day, Skinwalker Ranch had the big event. That was the day they were trying to move the ATIP program into Homeland Security. And they gave that briefing, that those two high level guys, and it was a 1-hour briefing, and end up 3.5 hours. And those guys went home and they couldn't sleep at night. So they must've done this real fear, this sort of stuff. But to me, it always looked like, I can see why fundamentalists would see that this is demons. Cause you had this kid, the only thing he was missing was the shaking bed. And it was, to me, the book was still a thing to build this fear that there's these evil entities that are in Skinwalker Ranch. And I think John Alexander even pointed that out today that I knew, and I think everybody knows, it's not just Skinwalker Ranch, it's that entire valley. There's one ranch that I was actually, I had some photos and we had posted them, and then the rancher told us to take them down, has stuff on his ranch and security cameras that, but it's like kindergarten at Skinwalker Ranch compared to what's going on this ranch. So it's that whole valley. And John pointed that out today in one of the email chains, that this is not just the ranch. So they made it to be the ranch. And so I think it's this idea of field theory, and that what you think about gets manifested. And so Chris Bledsoe has these positive experiences. I was very close to these objects, and that Kit Green was doing that stuff about if you get close, you're going to have these, you know, medical stuff. I was five times very, very close to the phenomenon in 1975, 76, nothing happened to me. So that's one of the things that sort of impressed me, was the fact that you could see this idea that these guys are, they're special weapons guys. And one of the things that I'm trying to check is, you know, the story where these guys are going down and they get the fear thing. This is what Chris experienced. And then they back away and the fear goes away. And then they get, try to move again, and the fear comes on again. And then they said it was almost like they were being told. And I heard the story that they were actually told. It was in their head. This voice said, "Leave, you are not welcome." And that was not in the book. Now, maybe I got that wrong. I think I know who made that statement. If that is true, that flips the whole book around, because we're having, it's like these evil things at Skinwalker Ranch, and they're a threat to the United States of America, and we got to go in there. And you have these commando guys, which I always said, were these guys armed when this thing happened? And they go in there, and they flips around and say, you guys are the bad guys, get out of here. And these guys left. And that was that's always been a big story, that story where they get stopped in the middle of that road. And I still think it's like a fear thing where they're trying to sell it. And that's why I think if you, even if the reports, because you saw those reports that were sent at the end that were in Appendix One, there was nothing there about Chris Bledsoe. And Chris Bledsoe, I think, maintains that he was the first STAR team person that they investigated, Bigelow investigated.
But those reports, dirds, were from OSAP. And his contention is the first person to visit was like Elizondo and others, and it was not OSAP then, because Elizondo was not part of OSAP ever, according to this book.
But could Chris Bledsoe be the guy Derek Jones they mentioned in chapter 12, or is that somebody else? Because
this is not secret. They only covered up government people who are active classification or worried about tainting the people that work with them. Chris Bledsoe's out in the open.
Yes. Yeah. My problem is that they only showed really bad things. Like they had this anecdotal story about some guy, you know, with the stuff in the orchard, and they wrote a 275 page report on it and stuff like that. And the material, there's nothing positive in there. When in fact, when you take a look at actual experiencers, 50% of all experiencers say at one point during their experience, somebody in themselves or somebody in their family was healed. You see none of that.
Tom has a question. Tom has a question.
Right.
Did they spend all the money? There was supposedly about $22 million. How much of that did they spend? Was some of it left over for Elizondo to work with?
The answer is no. It was pretty easy for me to check.
No, meaning what? They didn't spend it all?
They spent it all, and there was none for Elizondo.
Okay.
What did they spend the money on, though? I'm just curious. What did you
find? If you go look in the back of that book, they had millions of dollars worth of equipment. Millions.
Yeah. I think even Bigelow, the contention was Bigelow even put a lot of his own money in there.
Right. Right. So Elizondo was getting paid from somewhere, though. He had to be, right? I mean,
he had a regular job in the Pentagon. He had a regular job in the Pentagon. And so remember, I told you that ATIP continued from everything we read in this book, in and around, and other things that people have said, as an informal activity, like inside government, the same thing the Invisible College was doing outside the government.
Right. Well,
here's something that kind of caught my attention. But in a couple of places in the book, they said that Bass hired a former AFOSI investigator. And my first impulse was to think it was Richard Doty. And the reason why I say that is I've confirmed that Richard Doty worked for Hal Putoff for a time. But they actually did name a former AFOSI investigator in there. And I'm a little frustrated because I can't find it, but it's in there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Jerome something or other, but look, remember, that might be a pseudonym for Richard Doty if he didn't want to be in that book.
Yeah. Yeah,
Richard Doty. Yeah, because Hal Puthoff was a subcontractor to Bass, and then Doty worked for Puthoff. So
that's correct. Both of them have confirmed that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
94 to 2006.
And that overlaps Bass.
What were you going to say, Grant, about
No, this is just this idea of Richard Doty that Richard Doty told me the same thing, that he had worked with Hal Puthoff. In fact, when we had the alien autopsy document, he talked about the fact that he was involved. He didn't see the email, this alien autopsy email, but he said they met with Kit Green in his office and they had all sorts of discussions on this. NIDS was trying to figure out, was the alien autopsy for real?
So, but Grant, what were the revelations that you got reading this book that really hit you hard?
Well, you know? Mostly it was this idea of the what I would call field theory, is this idea that, like, shadow people appear in near-death experiences. They appear in psilocybin experiences. They appear all sorts of different stuff. Even we had a federal police officer who was, we had an experience where we were too close to a train track. There's a film crew, and they reported us to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And this guy came, it was an Aboriginal officer, and he started to get interest, and he wanted me to go and investigate all these Indian reservations where they had these shadow people and they wore hats. And so to me, it was like, the obvious thing is, like, why do aliens wear clothes? Why do aliens usually come naked or just with uniforms on? Why do ghosts wear clothes? And why do shadow people wear hats? I think I even asked Chris Bledsoe, did you see the guy with the hat? And he said, yeah, the shadow person with the hat. And so it was this idea that we're sort of pushing this idea, and this is all over the place. All this stuff is all connected. It's all paranormal phenomena. It's all even these guys that were on the road, they talked about the fact that it suddenly dropped 20 degrees in temperature, and that's classic ghost type stuff. So, you know, it's the idea that this is and that's why I say I feel, you know, sympathy for the Christian people. How would you know that it's an evil gray from Alpha Centauri that may not have a soul? I mean, you see it, you're basically looking at all this stuff that's paranormal phenomena, like ghosts and stuff like that. And, you know, you have a situation like with a ghost where somebody commits suicide or gets murdered in a house, and it leaves this sort of energy that all people will talk about, you know, psychics, and they can pick up this energy and stuff like that. That's the kind of stuff that amazed me. And I was always interested in what actually happened at Skinwalker Ranch. Forget about the UFO stuff, because as numerous people will say, you really can't determine anything by lights in the sky. You have to get to the actual paranormal stuff, and the experiencers are experiencing that. So the Skinwalker Ranch stuff really interested me. Even Brandon Fugel talking about this idea where, you know, these guys brought this evil stuff home and it was all bad and stuff like that. And if you look at Brandon Fugel talking in his interviews, when they go into the ranch, his brother flies him in on the helicopter. They pray as they go in. And he actually said in one post, there's a reflective aspect to this phenomena. It's almost like John Wheeler said, it's a participatory universe, or Seth the Chandler said, what happens around you manifest what happens around you. There is no other rule. And this idea that a lot of this stuff was very negative, but you had special forces guys who were, it may have been armed, and they were going in there. And George Knapp even said George Knapp said those that were most aggressive to the phenomena at Skinwalker Ranch had the worst experiences. So that's the part that sort of interested me, was the Skinwalker Ranch part, as to what was going on there. But to me,
let me point out one quick thing in support of something you said. I want to make sure that people, when they're reading this book, know the stuff that's in it that directly supports your belief and there's some kind of field theory going on. In every case where they bring in equipment, the equipment has an electromagnetic field interaction with whatever this phenomenon is. It drains batteries, it turns it off, it stops it functioning correctly. This is a manifestation of an electromagnetic field in and around this phenomenon. So There's all the testimony in this book about actual incidents shows there's an electromagnetic phenomenon, and shadow people are an interruption of your seeing the photons bouncing off the wall by something that's between you and the wall. If you see these shadow people, that is a field interaction from quantum electrodynamics. The photons are being blocked from getting to you. So all the your business about the field stuff is shown throughout this book. Is that the kind of field you're talking about? I don't know, but now there is this electrodynamic field theory called SEMI about the interaction of consciousness through electromagnetism. So there's something to what you're saying, but field theories are throughout this book.
Yeah.
Hey, Grant, isn't there a young boy who gets attacked by these blue orbs?
But that's what I'm saying. If you take a look at when that happens, they're trying to figure this out, because that was the same day they gave the briefing to Homeland Security. And they're trying to say, what's the relationship? Because it was the kid that got hammered by the orbs that night. Yeah. And
innocent.
Then something happened. And something, but the thing is, his father was one of the guys, the military guys that was stopped on the road, and he brought it home with him. And then his wife saw this, you know, what it was, this wolf, you know, looking at her very
dog man
looking very angry. I mean, did Chris Bledsoe have that? Did you have that when you came home to you and your wife, you came home? It's people are having different sort of experiences. And the concept is that maybe what you're, this idea that, you know, if you're very aggressive to the phenomena, or you go in there, even this thing where they said this latest guy they brought up in the book, the latest guy that at Skinwalker Ranch was very skeptical about the phenomena. And then he got hit by this this ray thing that injured him or whatever. And they bring this up as example. Well, this is what happened to me at Chris Bledsoe's house is when you have the skepticism stuff. When I had the thing with the dog, it happened 2 days before when I was at Chris's house, and the dogs kept getting let into the house, and it happened 3 times. And the front door was wide open, and I just thought, Chris is leaving the door open. And then when I come back 2 days later, that's when the experience with the dog, where the dog gets cut and the blood shooting all over the place. And to me, it was like very clear, because Chris thought it was the shadow people. I said, well, why would the shadow people do it? I said, you know what they want? They're doing a movie. At that time, he was doing that movie with Warner Brothers. And I said, they want this in the movie. They want this to be everybody to talk about this. And they're saying, you weren't impressed with the dogs being let in the house? Watch this. And it was, the blood was all over me. And it was like, and it was that kind of thing where you got to be careful when you're dealing with this phenomena, that it is interactive. And that's where the important thing was at the end, where they say, you got to look at the consciousness aspect of that. But if you look at the team that they brought on listed in the front of the book, there's nobody has any idea about consciousness or paranormal phenomena. You're bringing in special forces people. Like, what do they know about UFOs? I mean, they don't know anything. And you're treating it differently, and you have to respect. And I respect the fact that at the end of the book, they go there and they say, consciousness is part of this whole thing, and that has to be studied. And yet I don't see, except for Bigelow putting up $3.7 million back in the 1990s for a chair on consciousness studies at UNLV, Bigelow knew the connection, but I'm not sure they had anybody on there who really knew the background of paranormal phenomena and, you know, shadow people and this kind of stuff, because they come out with this impression, and I think they're trying to sell it. And that's why I don't think you see any discussion of anything positive or Chris Bledsoe or whatever, because nobody's going to give you any money. I mean, if you put that stuff in the thing, this is a report that's coming out that says this is the threat to the United States of America. And it comes down to basically the same as ghosts. I mean, where are we going to start, you know, taking black helicopters over houses that are haunted? I mean, it's basically a phenomena that they ran into. And I think the reason they went there, why Lukatsky went there, was because the whole idea is it's an anomaly. Anomaly means you got one of your building blocks is wrong. And if you go in and you study this bizarre phenomena of putting bulls in trailers and apports and manifestations and portals and all this kind of stuff, then you're going to figure out some stuff that you can use. And my big fear is, I point out, the Canadian government wrote a top secret memo in November of 1950. And people, if you go to WikiLeaks or whatever, or Wikipedia, they'll talk about MK Ultra starting in 53. It started in 51 in Montreal, 6 months after that top secret memo was written. And in the top secret memo, it was written, mental phenomena may be associated with the flying saucers. And the guy that was in the MK Ultra first meeting in June of 1951 was the same UFO guy that Wilbur Smith was reporting to in the Department of Defense. So that's my big fear, is that this stuff is all going to be turned and used for weapons. And I think there's another side to the story, that with these ideas of this thing appearing in front of Lukatsky or all these events with Kenneth Arnold that show that the phenomena is disclosing itself. It's like Jim Semivan said, it's running the show. It's doing the disclosure. And part of these, all these big events that they're showing is to get people to talk about it. It's the theory of, wow, why do UFOs have lights on them? They have lights on them so you can see them. They want you to talk about it. They want this out because they want consciousness raised to the point that everybody realizes the world is not as simple and nuts and bolts as we think it is.
Right. I have something interesting from the book I'd like to bring up.
Okay. Yeah,
that's okay. I'm going to read a paragraph. Shortly after the successful meeting with O'Toole at DHS, Sacha Mover and Jim Bell began knocking on doors beyond DHS to connect with the, quote, keepers of the secrets in at least two other agencies. In these meetings, which took place in June, July 2011, Sacha, Jim, and colleagues were treated rudely and harshly. Bell and Mover were repeatedly told no and hell no. This left Mover and Bell convinced that advanced technology was sequestered under government supervision at aerospace contractors' facilities. As a result, the DHS officials became very hesitant and even fearful of moving forward.
Well, that's in the Wilson leak document as well. The idea that they went to try to find it and they basically said, back off or you're going to lose a star. And that was what, what's his name from arms, from the Appropriations Committee, went to Area 51. His name's escaping me. He was a lawyer for Armed Service. The Senate Appropriations Committee heard that they were doing stuff at Area 51.
D'Amato.
Dick D'Amato. Bird, who ran the committee, was interested in UFOs. He said, are they doing UFOs at Area 51? And everybody on the committee said, I don't know. And they said, well, if they're doing UFOs at Area 51, they're not telling us either, and we're paying for the damn thing. So they send D'Amato there, and he talks to Knapp. He talks to everybody, talks to all the people, the top researchers, and he's trying to track this down. And he tells this Jesse Marcel Jr. tells this famous story where he says, I want to talk to you about Roswell. And he said, well, I've already talked. I've told everything. No, I'd like to tell you something. And they go into the sub-basement of the Capitol, and that's when D'Amato taps the majestic book written by Whitley Strieber and said, I just want to let you know, this is
yeah, but the problem now is D'Amato won't talk at all, right?
Well, he won't, but he may be scared. He's still frustrated. I've talked to people who have interacted with him, and he's still mad as hell that this thing got out of control, and that he called them people who didn't have any, they weren't elected, they had all the money and the stuff. But I would throw it out maybe even to Bob and to everybody. If this group, and I think people will admit, there's got to be a group there that controls, even Tom DeLong, where, you know, the when he's in the skiff, they're talking about like it's for real. So it appear that there is some group that has it. Why the cover up? Why are these very high level people telling people to get lost? And we're not even going to pay attention to anything you say.
And one more thing to add to that. Where's this worldwide database from all these countries with all that UFP files that's mentioned in the book? I mean, I think that's part of that question you're asking. Who's running the show on this end, right, Grant?
Well, that's a lower level, though. The report stuff, I even heard Bigelow had come to Canada. He made an offer to get the Canadian stuff. But Bigelow was buying up everything. And that was, now we sort of maybe assume that's what this is for. That he's using government money and he's putting all this stuff together. And that was, and they mentioned in there that Valet was running the computer end of it, that they always said, you needed all this material, gather all the material. And that was Bigelow's job to run around and get all this material. But that would be a lower database. That would just be UFO sightings from various countries and stuff. This is the big stuff. Like, where's the hardware? There's somebody that appears, from what Tom read and what I've heard, and everybody knows the rumor, that there's this elite group. Eric Walker told us there's an elite group, and if you were invited in, I would know. And we knew that he knew for sure, but he would never disclose anything. And that's the key. It's like, what's the thing? Is it about technology? Is it the fact that we don't know anything? Why do you think they're basically saying hell no, no, and hell no?
Grant, I've heard one explanation that intrigued me, and that's that they don't want the Christian crazies to get a hold of it. You know, they'll suppress it completely. Even, well, as if it's not already suppressed enough.
Well, but I can see, I mean, if I can see that some religious preacher is going to get hold of this book and make hay out of it. Because, I mean, if you take out the tic-tac thing, it looks like demons, man. It's exactly like demons. There are no aliens. There are no, it's, you know, it's this mysterious stuff in the bedrooms and scary stuff. And, you know, it's injuring people and especially the dark thing. I mean, it's always been known that the dark shadowy thing is Satan. I mean, it's like, you know, the prince of darkness. I mean, it's like, that's what, so I can see that the people would be very upset in the Pentagon that, or the people would be trying to stop this thing. Because if you don't have the background, you and I have the background on UFOs, but if you don't have the background on UFOs, like that briefing that was given at Homeland Security, I think they said in the book, those guys did not sleep at night. These are high level Homeland Security. I mean, if you take a Christian preacher in there and give him that briefing, what do you think he's going to say? I mean, he's going to be flipping out like, wow, man, the devil's here and the second coming's coming and stuff like that. I can relate to.
But in the book, you know, they mentioned there are all these databases, like 11 databases. And I wouldn't be surprised if Jacques Vallée had a hand in writing the API or something. It did sound like
he put it together. That was his whole idea, was you got to get all the material.
But in the book, they don't talk about any analysis of the database or any findings. I mean, that database, that all those databases have a whole lot of UFO information. So it's not just about shadow people and dogmen.
I really want to emphasize how much I agree with Tom. But again, this feels to me like when they submitted the book to the government for pre-publication approval, the government said, you got to cut all this out about where these databases were landed. Right. And so no one knows where to send an FOIA request to get them. Or it's inside one of these corporate controlled with government on the side SAPs, and no one will have access to it, not even the president of the United States, because it's owned by a corporation.
Yeah, because what I look at is the slide 9. If you look at the slide 9, the big fear slide, that's all Skinwalker Ranch. That's all. I mean, the sightings can tell you, yeah, that we are not alone, that UFOs are real. But what can you really get out of the Canadian database with 20,000 sightings that were reported by people on the street? You're going to get a certain amount of material. But if you can get onto a place like Skinwalker Ranch, like a laboratory where this you're interacting and you've got metal, you know, you've got equipment picking up electromagnetic fields and stuff like that, and you're actually interacting with whatever is behind the phenomena. And that's why I always said experiences like Chris Bledsoe are very important, because they're interacting with whatever it is that's creating this whole phenomena.
You know, you talk about slide 9, but that was clearly an A-tip slide. So what was the relationship between A-tip and ASWAP with as far as information? And, you know,
well, no, but the slide 9, if you take a look at the stuff on slide 9, they're talking about the potential danger. And if you look at the stuff they're listing, it's like going through metal or something. I haven't got the slide, but it's sort of like this stuff about talking in people's heads.
And interface. Like
And that's the thing. So that was the kind of stuff that was happening at Skinwalker Ranch. They're using it to brief. So when they get the material, they get the Skinwalker stuff, which is where I think the main real hardcore stuff is. They get this stuff and they say, look, I mean, if they put these bulls inside trailers, there was a locked trailer. I mean, this is just unbelievable technology, and that's where you scare people, or they can get inside your head. That was the whole MK Ultra thing in Canada, was this idea that mental phenomena was involved, and suddenly this MK Ultra thing starts and people are trying to control consciousness and get inside people's heads and figure this whole thing out. It's the slide 9 to me, when I looked at it, it all seemed to be stuff from Skinwalker Ranch, the stuff that they're learning there, because there was a lot of really weird stuff. And if you were a DIA guy, you would say, man, if we could figure this thing out, or worse yet, if the Russians figure this out and they can, you know, make stuff disappear or get inside the president's head and stuff like that, you could scare the living daylights out of somebody with that kind of material of what was happening at Skinwalker Ranch.
Okay. I want to point out that whatever ATIP lists in any of its documents, it would have had access to the work and the report products and other things from OSAP. It would have had access. Go ahead, Tom.
That's my question with this database and all of these reports. And by the way, the Bass people worked their tails off and produced all kinds of stuff. But all these reports in the database, Bob, do you think that DIA and or DOD is actually or has actually looked at that, or is it just collecting dust?
I think Lukatsky, before he retired, disseminated widely, because remember, he was walking it around to DHS and other places, and they were wowed by the work that had been done. I can't not believe how much unbelievable science and engineering was done for a measly $22 million. But Bigelow must have paid for a lot of that by augmenting the funds by some mechanism, because that is a lot of work.
But if he was going to DHS, if they were going to DHS, it's because DOD didn't want it.
They were going to DHS because they couldn't talk anyone in DOD to allow the funding to continue. They were trying to keep the activity going.
Yeah. And the other thing I mentioned, like you talk about the money, even you take this study where you mentioned Kit Green, and we all knew they were doing this study where they went to, I know for sure, because Peniston writes about it in his book, where they come to Peniston and they offer him a full disability in exchange for his DNA and the brain scan, and they're doing the whole brain scan and the DNA and all this kind of stuff. And that's big money. I mean, you're doing DNA stuff on all these people. And according to what he told Peniston, there was 8 people working on it. Bigelow was the contractor. It was run by the Defense Department. That's big time money. When you start doing DNA and you're moving
it's
around,
the year.
And getting medical
records. It's the year of that.
Well, Peniston's got it in his book. And it seems like it was about 2013, 2014 when Kit Green came to him, and he basically said, I wasn't injured, but he said, I'm going to find out what you're doing. And that's when he said, we're trying to figure out how does it pop in and pop out, which indicated to me, they know a little bit more. And that it gets into this idea about portal technology, wormholes, that they have some concept. It's more than just, you know, watching stuff fly around, that they have some idea of how this thing is operating.
Given the expense involved in that stuff, that lets you know for a fact that there was money put on this work after OSAP ended because of the date.
Yeah. And you would just hide the money. I mean, that works in the Defense Department. You put it under another name or whatever, that if especially if it's going darker, if it's going blacker, then it just sort of disappears, and they want you to think that it was shut down, or, you know.
Well, that's a whole other topic too, is Kit Green's approach to the immune system, yeah, being like a super database and information system. I think that's really an interesting subject.
Yeah, that was him and Nolan. Yeah.
I was going to show you slide 9, Grant. Do you see? This is slide 9. Yeah. This is the stuff you're talking about. Psychotronic weapons. Is this, you're saying ASWAP is the research and it was just put out as ATIP?
So, yeah, well, they're just using the material. What they're doing is they're looking into all the databases and what they've got to try to sell this thing to Congress. You want to find all this stuff. So whether you're getting it from ATIP or from Skinwalker Ranch or wherever you're getting it from, they're gathering all this material that would indicate there's a threat there that either we figured out or the Russians figured out. And if the Russians get all this kind of stuff, then like the sensor disassembliation, the instant sensor disassembly, that was, to me, was the whole deal at Skinwalker Ranch, when they had the two cameras looking at each other and the one camera gets ripped down and they go and look at the other camera and there's nothing on the camera. That's the kind of stuff where if you're a DIA guy, you're going to look at that and go, how the hell did they do that? And if we could figure out to do that, that's some technology, because everything's going to work on a principle, a physical principle or a principle. There's going to be a law. And if you can figure out the law, there's a lot of technology there.
It's the last line here in slide 9 that really is key. I think must have been Alessandro. What was considered phenomena is now quantum physics. I mean, that's what Alessandro's sort of been hinting at. They're trying to understand this advanced science, because we can't understand it with Newtonian linear mechanistic science. So,
just indicates that's the whole thing behind the anomaly thing. I always point out with the anomaly, when you have an anomaly, it means you're trying to put a puzzle piece in a puzzle that's from a different puzzle. It's not going to fit. And you have to figure out the anomaly. Almost like Einstein said, you cannot solve a problem using the same information you used to create the problem. Or William James said, you think you're thinking and you're actually just rearranging your prejudices. You've got to get new materials. So that's why anomalies are so important at Skinwalker Ranch. If you go in and you figure out how the anomaly works, then you've got technology. And Bob can back me up on this whole idea about lead time in weapons. It's the whole idea that if you drop an atomic bomb on the Japanese and they go to the emperor and say, oh, they just dropped this atomic bomb. And he said, well, build an atomic bomb and drop it on them. And they said it's going to take like 7 years to build. And it's this lead time weapon. You can even have 2 days lead time on your enemy and win the war. You have to, it's the whole idea is is you get something that your enemy can't, he has not got time to build, that you're ahead. So that's what this, why it's so important to get this material, is this whole idea that if the Russians get it, or the Chinese get it, or whoever they see as enemies, if they get it and we do, and they use it on us, we haven't got time to build it, to fight back. They've got us, these super weapons. Everybody's looking, and it comes in the anomalies. It comes in these really weird things that indicate there's a new technology there.
Yeah, and Harry Reid says that stuff explicitly in the preface to this book. The reason he started going forward with it is he had all these intimations that the Chinese and the Russians were going crazy trying to get this stuff, and that's the reason he put the thing forward with Inouye and Stevens.
Yeah. Hey, someone on Clubhouse asked, who is the DHS team that in Chapter 12? They seem like a whole separate thing from the ASAP tracking program. The DHS people, do you know who that?
They're listed by name. We don't know if that's pseudonyms or not, but they had nothing to do with DOD because ASAP was a DOD project.
Right.
But
Homeland Security,
like you said, they were trying to continue ASAP, and they went to DHS. And some of the DHS people were, according to the book, were really positive about it. And then they went, I think they went out trying to see if they could, you know, get some funding.
Yeah, it was so just trying to rescue the program.
And they ran into a brick wall.
But where's the book leave us now, Grant and Aaron, and Bob and Tom? What doors does this open up? And where's the further investigation that we can
pursue? I think we have 1,000 breadcrumbs from this book to follow. And that's typically how investigations are done.
Yeah, and you're going to have all sorts of FOIAs and new material and leaks. And you got Alessandro's book coming. So Alessandro's going to have to trump this book with some new stuff. And it's unraveling pretty well, I think, in terms of how this is going. I mean, who would have believed this 4 years ago, that this would all happen in 4 years?
As soon as I saw the article in the New York Times, I went, if this continues, they're going to blow the door open.
Yeah, especially when you get, again, you're going to have major media. And I always said, when the major media realizes they've been had, the blood's in the water, and the sharks are going to start circling.
And
these
it
guys
is.
Have all got contact inside the Pentagon, and they're going to read this book, and they're going to go, "Holy shit! It's even more real than we thought it was." New names, and they're going to start, you know, shaking the bushes, and it's all going to leak out. It's just a matter of time.
Maybe it's too much for major media, because I haven't seen it in any major media, this book. I mean,
well, but they once they read it, then they've got their sources. Then they start working on stories, because a lot of these stories take months to do. You got to track them, and they're all looking for the scoop. They're looking for the Pulitzer Prize. And that's the thing, is these guys have access to people inside the Pentagon that you and I don't have access to.
Yep. Yep. And it's just going to take time. But look, it took a long time to go from 2017, 2016 and 17, and Tom DeLonge doing To the Stars Academy, till you had some feisty Senate Intelligence Committee and House Committee people pushing the Pentagon and DNI to give a report. It took years. And they're just trying, I think, the government is slowly but surely acknowledging something that they want to acknowledge without blowing things up.
Go ahead, Tom.
The question in my mind is there a part of the government that's covertly collecting UFO information?
Well, almost surely, yes, but we don't know what it is.
If they're not doing that, then pessimistically, the whole Lukatsky sequence is very discouraging. He's like the lonely Maytag repairman over there. there's nothing else going on. Now, according to Richard Doty, if you listen to him, the DIA has been collecting all the UFO information, you know, since they closed down Blue Book, you know, and they follow abductions and all that. So that could all be a special access program that Lukatsky was never read into.
That's correct.
Yeah, and they've been following Chris Bledsoe, and we all know the stories. I mean, they're very interested in, you know, who his contacts are, and can you get this stuff, and this idea that went up to the president, they asked for information and it was taken up to the president. So they got to be careful. Maybe you can explain this, Bob, this idea about they can't interact with civilians, this whole idea that you're looking at military stuff, but you really can't start spying on American people and tapping phones and stuff like that.
You can't without a warrant from a FISA court.
Okay.
There's a FISA court.
but in a UFO stuff, to collect UFO stuff would be fairly difficult. You'd have to have a.
That's the reason I think every bit of that stuff is being done with government on the side at corporations.
Yeah.
So, but well, let me ask you, why do they bring the abduction phenomena into this? It has affected, they admit, hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, doesn't that open up a huge can of worms for everyone who's been involved in that? And the government is admitting to it now. So where's that leave all these abductees?
Got a book that admits there's abductions and experiencers, but you don't have government reports saying we were looking at a bunch of experiencers. You have Lukatsky claiming that he was motivated by this, but Lukatsky is not a government spokesman. They're not saying it.
Grant, in response to your comment about interacting with U.S. people, I've been working on a paper on AFOSI, and I've been reading these government regs, you know, and Air Force directives, and they're not supposed to interact with U.S. people, but there are loopholes in that. For example, they can do it if they have approval from upper management. And now I'm not talking about tapping phones. Bob's right. You have to have a warrant for that. But just, you know, interacting with people, if they think they have a reason, you know, like a counterintelligence reason, they can do that. Also, open source information is fair game. So they can attend a UFO conference, you know, just like anybody in the public could. And also, I just had a conversation with a former AFOSI guy a few days ago, and he said they can monitor somebody for 90 days before they have to go to management and get further approval. So there are some loopholes in that.
Okay, for a counterintelligence investigation. Remember, the counterintelligence people are not trying to build a case for a legal action. They're trying to build an intelligence product. So if you've got to go across a line and start writing stuff down to pass it to law enforcement, then you got to go and do a whole lot more getting approvals. But as long as you're taking notes down for a counterintelligence operation so you can figure out who's talking to who and who's passing secrets and all this other stuff, you can do the counterintelligence work. Richard Doty did it against U.S. citizens in their own home.
Okay, well, but yeah, what is the risk to benefit? Because you can sort of get around, but you know what happened to the Church Committee in 76? If you get caught, I think even Alessandro talked about this. You can't walk around the Pentagon without a lawyer following you. That everything you do gets checked. So if you're the boss, are you going to authorize, okay, we need this data? Is it worth getting a couple of UFO sightings or something in order to sort of bypass this when you know eventually it's going to leak out and all hell's going to break loose?
Every high level intelligence meeting that I've been to where an operational decision was being made, and I've been to a bunch of them, the general counsel or whoever agencies were in that meeting are in the meeting. They're there every time.
Yeah. I remember Bill Moore talking about that, because that was the whole thing about the Cattle relation, that, you know, nobody could figure it out. And then the theory came out that it was the American government. And then he made the point. He said the American government would never risk crashing a helicopter in order to get a couple of cattle. This doesn't make any sense. It's this risk versus what you're going to get out of it. You always got to weigh that. And unless there's a really good reason to go for it, you're not going to step over that line, because, you know, the risk is just too much in terms of if it falls apart and you lose it. Even like the thing where you're rescuing people from other countries and stuff like that with special operations. If it falls apart, you know what? It's like the whole, you know, you look really bad, and you could, the president could come down over it.
Well, and another loophole is a volunteer, you know, in the intelligence world. I'm sure you all have heard of walk-ins. You know, if you walk into AFOSI or the Air Force or whatever and volunteer information, then that's fair game. You know, they don't necessarily have to have higher permission to work with you on that.
That is correct. That happens everywhere in everything with an investigative arm. People walk in.
And that's what happened with Benowitz. Benowitz was a walk-in.
Hey, Bob, in the beginning of the program, we talked about Elizondo and Danny Sheehan. And so if he really didn't work for ATO, or maybe he did, but what is the case Danny Sheehan claims to have with their wiping out Elizondo's record and the whistleblower complaint?
So, look, Elizondo, even though he worked for the government, he's a citizen. He has rights. Okay. So, but all of his stuff that he left behind at work is covered by federal regulations, and they are federal records. So the one of the complaints is they wiped out all of his classified emails, and that required very high level review to be able to pull off, and there would be a record of it. And so Danny Sheehan's going in there saying, look, you can't do this, and we're going to find out whether, if we go to court, who ordered these records to be wiped out. So that's a threat. The other thing is he's had these constant threats of removing his security clearance so he can no longer do the work. And they're going to fight that like a bat out of hell. And they're going to bring a lawyer in. They're going to try to threaten them with exposure and disclosure in any kind of trial or civil deal. And of course, Danny Sheehan is no child. He went in there and they tried to play the game. Okay, let's sign these NDAs and then we can talk openly. And Danny Sheehan went, oh, hell no, I'm not signing an NDA. And when I leave here, I'm going to tell everybody everything you sons of bitches said. I mean, it's just, you know, they're playing hardball and they're backing the people inside the Pentagon into a corner. And what they're trying to do is protect Elizondo's ability to earn a living and so forth, and just have them stop trying to make him out to be a liar to cover up what they don't want told. I think Danny and Elizondo are doing exactly what they should do.
And when I talk to
they wipe out his record, what do you think he would say in those emails? That go ahead.
Well, it would document exactly what happened, because they're saying he didn't work there, none of this happened, and the emails are going to document everything that happened.
And whoever Danny, he talked to, yeah, whoever Danny, he emailed.
Danny said to me, he said he thinks it's all BS. He doesn't think they destroyed anything. They're just trying to use that. But he said, like, what's the point? I mean, he knows who exactly the emails were sent to. All those guys' emails are there. They're not going to know whose other emails they're going to have to destroy. And according to what they had said was, a lot of these people have come back to Elizondo and said they've been talked to. Because Danny said, not only do we want an investigation, we're going to tell you exactly who to talk to and exactly what's going on. And we need you to go. And they're documenting it, that you got to talk to this guy, this guy's involved. And so they're going to go to all the people the emails were and assemble this stuff. So it's a crazy idea to think you can actually destroy it. But the idea of destroying it is just, oops, we destroyed the document. What are you going to do then? You're going to reprimand some guy? Like, you can't really do anything. But in this case, it's true that if he sent emails to 50 different people, there's no way you're going to stop. You're going to have to destroy a lot of people's files in order to get to all those emails.
That I'm telling you, a good independent counsel, and I assure you the Pentagon has good independent counsels. They are capital I independent.
Yeah.
They do not get bossed by the Secretary of Defense or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they have plenary powers. They can go anywhere they want and look at anything they want. And that's what Elizondo and Sheehan are threatening these people who are trying to do obstruction behind the scenes. We're going to pry open the door and make you show everything. And as soon as we're told, we're going to tell everybody.
Yeah.
They're backing them into a corner.
And that's where people are saying, well, where do we go next? You've got the Elizondo book, plus you've got these Inspector General reports coming out. And Danny Sheehan and describing, there could be all sorts of major bombs that drop in the next couple of months.
Isn't Elizondo going to have to clear his book through DOD too?
Yes. Yes, he will. If he doesn't want to go to jail.
Yeah.
So how much of this book you think was taken out that we just don't know?
You need to do what I did. I read it twice in preparation for this meeting. And I kind of got a list of places where it just like broke, where the story narrative was going, and all of a sudden it broke. That to me is a clear cut case of where they just X'd out a bunch of stuff and didn't finish, because the narrative wasn't finished. They just left it pregnant.
Right. Yeah. Tom, what do you think is the next step for this whole movement? Where do you think it's going?
Well, the obvious next step is for the John Greenwalds of the world to try to file FOIAs on
absolutely a lot of John and everybody else. File a million of them.
But if
that takes time,
this theory that there's a proprietary interest on Bigelow's side and they're not going to release it because of that, if that's the theory, then I think you're going to have to sue. You're going to have to go to court. and sue in court to try to get some of this information released. But we have to realize, too, there's a big chronological gap here. All of this occurred 10, 11, 12 years ago. You know, what's been going on since then? Right. And so we're still left with crumbs from the banquet table, and we have nothing but a million questions left.
Well, they threw in some stuff in the last year that, like the George Knapp, Jeremy Corbell stuff that's come out, the videos and other things. They threw in a few crumbs from recently, but there's still a gap. There's a gap from 2013 to 2017 or 18, and some gaps even after that, because we're not hearing. Look, the silly report reports only things that happened after Nimitz, and that's just crap. We know there's 1,000 things that happened before the Nimitz, and they're not mentioning them at all in this report. Now, the language that was being pushed recently in the National Defense Authorization Act says they're going to have to reveal this stuff, but there's no place in there where it mandates a public report.
Right.
So it's likely to go to these committees under classified terms, and they may see some stuff, and maybe it'll leak, maybe it won't. But I just don't think the public's going to get a report on anything else that happened before 2004, especially the Air Force and the Army Air Force. They just do not want everything that's written and written as to Roswell to be exposed.
Well, what about Project Blue Book? I mean, that's out there. I mean, that's
1940. Well, Alan, I was going to mention that because here we have this database from OSSAP, you know, and they said in the book that there are 200,000 reports in there, if you include everything. So apparently the people that wrote this report that came out from the DNI, in June, apparently they didn't look at that. And that makes me wonder if it's just collecting dust.
Well, they need some money. I mean, in terms of doing all this kind of stuff, I think that's what they're pushing, is to get some money to handle this. And they're using the AI. That's the Jacques Vallée's big thing, is to use AI rather than, you know, people thumbing through reports to try to find patterns and stuff like that.
There must be someone working on this full time. I don't think it's collecting dust. There's an intelligence on the government side.
But that's what my big thing is, if you've got the reports, but are the people that are at the top level, the guys that we talk about, these super secret elite groups, are they doing UFO sightings, or are they building crafts and looking at physics and stuff like that? I think they're more into trying to understand the sort of the paranormal aspect of this thing, because I'm going to claim it. And they went there. This is going to have a lot to do with consciousness. There's a huge consciousness connection. And so I can't see that the elite guys, that may be why they shut down Blue Book. That was a story we heard. They shut down Blue Book and moved it to the contractors in 69, and Nixon moved it to the contractors. So
how do you talk about consciousness to nuts and bolts guys involved in military with no background in any metaphysics or spiritual awakening? How would you do that?
Well, they get dragged in, though, when they get confronted with the fact that this idea that they, you know, when they did this briefing to Homeland Security, these two events happened in one side of the country and on the other side of the country at exactly the same time. And they picked up the significance that there was some connection. And that's the whole thing, is they propose that there's these committees that are formed or whatever with private money to look at this stuff. And they actually mentioned that consciousness should be looked at. So they're going to have to bring these people in. I don't know who they're going to bring or what they're going to do, but at least they've acknowledged the fact that there is this connection, which before I would never have brought that up.
And that in the chapter that Lukatsky wrote in this book, he clearly speaks to talking about paranormal consciousness and psychonetic and et cetera, projection of images into other people's minds and so forth. He talks about that clearly being a motivating factor for OSSAP. And so he had Bigelow study it, because Bigelow was already funded consciousness studies at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, took quite a bit of money. So he already knew that Bigelow and Colm Kelleher were involved in all this. And so he was interested in both that and the nuts and bolts.
There's a funny story was told with NIDS when Bigelow first started NIDS, what is 95 or whatever. He said they had all these scientists there, and he said, we're going to be looking at survival of consciousness after death and UFOs. And the one scientist apparently said, really? Why don't we just do Sasquatches and ESP? So we've come a long way since 1995. Well,
Hey, is Chris Bledsoe joining us, Grant? Did he get?
I gave him an offer, but he actually has some people. It's his 60th birthday, and he has some people who don't want to mention visiting him for his birthday. But I had said to him to drop in because I think he's an important part of this thing. He was the guy who was telling me in 2015, 2016 that this thing was going to drop. He told me very clearly. High-level people are going to come forward. They're going to say UFOs exist, and they are going to disclose. And they're going to put the big man on 60 Minutes, and he kept going. So he was ahead of this game, 5 years ahead of everybody else.
Hey, Bob has to leave in 10 minutes. Bob, give us like your whole intense summation, and what do you think, guys?
To me, follow the breadcrumbs, and this book tells us the viewpoint of the people that started all of this inside the government. There's a trail you can follow. You can follow the contract Lukatsky gave to Bigelow and Bass in Fed BizOps. That's how I figured out that it was essentially a sole source contract by the way they did it. They pulled the trigger. Bass was already set up. They gave people under a month to respond, and Bigelow's the only one responded. Boom, he won it. I mean, this was set up for Bigelow to win.
I don't think anyone else even knew about it, to tell you the truth. I mean,
it was public. It was readable in public, but no one else had time to respond. They followed the letter of the law, and Bigelow got what Bigelow got what he wanted.
The whole disclosure movement seems to, like, in the past, before this book had started with Elizondo, he worked for ATIP. He says something's going on here. It's not being public. I'm going to quit ATIP and go public with that. But it seems like this book is saying something else.
Well, but I'm sure that Elizondo, in this informal activity where he was blessed by his bosses to do it, he got frustrated because he was constantly trying to get activities needed, actually funded, and gain access to the core secrets, and he couldn't get access to it. So he says, fine, I'll just take what I knew and go blow the door open.
Yeah. It leads me to a question about how orchestrated do you think these guys like Elizondo, and you see this sort of planning for Bigelow to get the contract? Do you think this is very orchestrated? Because you mentioned the Elizondo quitting. And I may have the date wrong, the data wrong, but he quit in the morning, and the New York Times, he was meeting with him in the afternoon, along with Hal Putoff and a contractor and Jim Semivan. And it looks like, to me, it's way more orchestrated, as if they know exactly where they're going to go next. And this is like a playbook that they're following.
So look, the necessary information to write the New York Times article, Mellon and Elizondo and others orchestrated its release, its declassification, so that Leslie Keen could take it and show it to her editors with Ralph Blumenthal and Helene Cooper, because the New York Times is not going to run that article without proof. So all of that stuff was orchestrated while they were still in the door. Yeah. And once they got the article out, they left the door.
Then let me ask you, Bob, a question about this thing, because Elizondo resigns and then he meets with the New York Times. What's the thing about these, like, Semivan's retired, Mellon's retired, Justice is retired, Elizondo's retired. Is there this thing that you retire and then you're able to operate? Because if you remember the story with Jim Semivan, he said he knew about Chris Bledsoe in 2008 or whatever, but he was not allowed to meet with him until he retired. So can you explain how that works, where it appears like these people are retiring and then they're allowed to do a lot more than they could if they were in a government employee?
Just like the reason I think the way the core secrets works is people are in government. They get trained how the levers of government work by being inside the government. They're vetted, they're cleared, they're exposed to all sorts of functions in the government. But if they are going to go work where the core secrets are, we all believe it's inside of corporations. They have to leave the government to go be inside those corporations. So, yes, I think this is planned. And this is part of the big revolving door controversy in the United States. People learn how, look, I did it. I learned how to do all sorts of stuff in the government, and I retired, went to Virginia Tech, and started two companies. And because I knew both of those companies filled a need that was not being met by anyone, but I married that with understanding that technology got into the place where I could do stuff knowing what was needed that other people might not do. And so I'm just telling you, they know that they can leave and go to work for the corporations because the corporate revolving door has not been plugged. And so it's just the standard way to do things. And in this case, well, Elizondo had a mission.
When they retire, they can talk a lot more, Grant, but as long as they don't disclose any classified information.
Okay, but one of the expressions I heard that Kit Green had said, you have a security clearance, a top secret security clearance when you're in the government, but when you go to the contractor, then you get the real security clearance.
But there's that, and furthermore, when you sign these NDAs, they are lifelong commitments.
Yeah.
So what about the idea of Elizondo running for Congress to get out of an NDA? Is that just
if he gets elected to Congress, he could walk into the well of a House and speak whatever he wants to, and they can't do a whole lot to him. Okay, so. And I think he can walk further over the edge than he has. Okay. So I just, but look, the minute Elizondo declares what party he's in, he's going to make enemies to the other 50% in the United States. I just don't think it's a win for Elizondo to get into politics.
And he's doing pretty well.
Well, it takes money too. I mean, you got to have money to run for anything.
Yeah. I think he's doing pretty well the way he is right now. He's rocketing up in popularity and everybody's listening to him. And, I think he could probably do very well with what he's doing right now. And that's where I think there's a plan. I think this is, especially when I heard Chris tell me many, many years ago that this was all going to happen. It was, people think it's just, they're just, you know, taking one step at a time. Even when Elizondo left to the stars, he said he's moving into second gear. And I go, did Senate give that money out yet? And it's like, you could almost see that this is all sort of orchestrated and, I think
this book is part of it. Then this book is part of that plan. And you were saying, Bob, in the beginning, George Knapp is really central to all of this.
He is absolutely central to putting all these relationships together that have made all this happen. George Knapp, every one of us owe him a pat on the back and a shake of his hand. And I had underestimated his importance until this book and other things have come out, because he blew the door off on Area 51. He put Harry Reid and Bob Bigelow together in NIDS. He's just constantly building relationships that have led to big things.
Bob Lazar, even, right? That was huge.
Yeah, big. That's what I'm talking about, Area 51. It was on TV as he was having worked at Area 51 and did this stuff where he took John Lear and others out to the desert and showed them the video and helped them video craft flying. Okay, so I need to leave in a couple of minutes, unfortunately.
Okay, maybe we should shut it down then, because I think we've sort of run the gamut.
Tom, why don't you just wrap up what you're saying here with all of this?
I think George Knapp has been wonderful, but he only goes so far. I think we need a Woodward and Bernstein, New York Times level, real team to really break this thing open. And I'm not optimistic about that, but I think that's what we really need. And Alan, it's nice to meet you. It's good to see you, sir.
Thank you. I haven't finished the book. That's why I will, though. I will next time we talk. But Grant, just give us a few more insights like you that you had to write down as you were reading it. And Bob, if you have to go, then
I didn't really have much. I was just very interested to finally see the Skinwalker Ranch part be talked about, because I think that's where the important stuff is. And I was very impressed with the book, and especially the idea that consciousness was actually put on paper and this is the real deal. It's almost like the New York Times article that now we can talk about consciousness without people laughing, because it's actually down there. And that's what the New York Times article did, is it opened it up for people in the Pentagon to talk to each other, that you didn't have to hide in a closet and stuff like that. And it's the same thing with this, that it's opened up a new aspect to this phenomena, consciousness, which I think is extremely important. And I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
No, thanks. Thanks. I'm sorry Nicole couldn't join us. I know she always has great questions, but thanks, guys.
Okay. Well,
Grant, so thanks.
We'll shut it down, and maybe once Elizondo's book comes out, we'll do another one. Or if the New York Times breaks another big story, we'll.
I'd like to have a conversation with Nick Pope about this, and maybe Whitley. He's mentioned in the book. Would you want to do that?
Sure. Sure. But I mean, I'm open. Yeah. The more discussion we have, that's how it works.
And Tom, what's your background? What's your
Well, my working background was in the financial industry. I worked in banks and credit unions, and I retired as far as
the UFO field.
As far as UFO, you know, I got interested in it when I was 12 years old when I started reading Donald Kehoe books. But I got active around 1990, and I joined MUFON. I became a MUFON field investigator and state section director, and I was invited on the board in 1995, and I've been on the board ever since. But my area of interest is the MJ-12 affair and the history of the MJ-12 affair. And in 2019, I was able to retire from regular employment, so I'm putting full time into that.
Right. Well, hey, thanks, Grant. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it. Yeah.
Okay, and let's do it again. And thank you, everybody, for joining and all the people watching. And new stuff will be coming, so we'll sit tight and wait for it.
Yeah. Thank you, Grant. Thank you, Dustin.
But the book is worth reading. I think everybody agrees this is a key book to read. Don't leave it alone. Even if you get the Kindle, it's pretty cheap. And you'll learn some new stuff you've never known before.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's more pieces coming together, but there's a lot of pieces still remaining. Bob said, this is 12 years old.
But that's the how the universe works. It's like Niels Bohr said. David Bohm said, when you figure out the whole quantum physics thing, there's just another level below that. So it's like it's a learning process. You're never going to learn the answers to everything in the universe. We sometimes want everything yesterday. This is about the experience rather than the journey. Because I even Jim Semivan said, I don't think I'll ever live long enough to see this thing actually unravel. And you got to remember, he was face to face with the intelligence in his bedroom. So here's a guy, high level CIA guy, who doesn't think we're ever going to get the thing. He said it's got something to do with consciousness, multidimensionality. It's way beyond that we can deal with in science. So it's going to be a long haul, but an exciting thing. It's the Super Bowl of all stories.
Exists. That's a great line. I love that line.
Thank you, Alan.
Okay. Thank you. Well, paranormal seems to be normal now. I mean, right? It's come into fashion. So
beautiful. And let's do it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.